everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to welcome our guest, Gary Mishras. Gary is the Managing Partner and Chief Investment Officer of Silver Ring Value Partners, an investment firm with a concentrated long-term intrinsic value strategy. He also teaches the Value Investing Seminar at F.W. Olin Graduate School of Business. As always, for those out there in the audience, please feel free to post your questions throughout the presentation. They can be anything on the presentation, but just keep in mind that we will be holding those until we get to the Q&A at the end, and we'll go ahead and dive into those questions with Gary. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead and hand things over, and we can jump into the presentation.
Well, thank you, Graham, and thank you very much to Guru Focus for having me, and I hope you guys in the audience will get a little bit of something up from this. Graham, give me a thumbs up if the audio is running smoothly, and I'll go on. All right, I have the thumbs up from the master, so I'm going to start. So hopefully you guys can see the slides. Here's the things I want to cover today. I think origins in investing really matter, and the reasons for being an investor also matter. And so I'm going to talk about that. I think I'm going to touch on the value versus growth debate. I think the best way to do it is maybe addressing it through some examples. I know it's been a hot topic recently. And then I'll go through my investment process briefly, leaving plenty of time for your questions. So let's jump in. So I think, as I said, early experiences do matter. And I'm going to tell you a quick story about something that influenced me very early on. I'll leave my bio slide on for you to look at, but actually that's not what I want to talk about at all. So my family is Jewish, and we immigrated from the former Soviet Union or Russia when I was around 10. So that was over 30 years ago. And as part of the immigration process, you had to leave most of your money and most things behind. You were only allowed to kind of bring one thing per person of each kind. So one ring, one watch, and so forth. And when I was younger, when I was 8 or 9, my mom gave me a little gold ring. And that gold ring was hers when she was a child. And so it was important to me. But I couldn't bring it because, you know, we had more valuable rings that we had to bring as our three-ring allotment. It was me, my mother, and my grandmother that were coming over. So as part of the migration process, we lived in a town outside of Rome in Italy, about 45 minutes. The town's name is Ladispoli. I actually went back there. You know, the whole place is still there, the same way I remember. And you know, we were poor. We didn't have very much. And we were selling our things at the local market, the bazaar that the immigrants set up for the Italians. And in broken Italian, I would say, Signori, una mille, mira, por favor, un mille. A mille, this is before the euro, was basically 1,000 lira. It was about maybe 70 cents at the time, something like that. And that was I cornered the market on matches, so little wooden matches with commemorative stickers on them that the Italians love. But my biggest sale was actually not matches. It was an empty suitcase from what my mom was selling to get by. And I sold that for a grand total of 5 mil, which is kind of like $3.50. I was really proud of myself. And also, I was really excited because on the way to the market, there was this jewelry store that I kept passing by. And in the window, I kept seeing this gold ring that was just like the one I left behind in Russia. And so I kind of, you know, never had any money. I wouldn't dare even ask my mom for money for a ring because we barely had enough to eat. And so I finally, when I sold the suitcase, I went to her and said, Mom, can I use the money? You know, she would let me keep the money for my small sales. Can I use the money to sell this, to buy this ring, right? And she said, sure, if that's what you want. And I said, I do. And so I went in there. I looked around. I talked, you know, they looked at me kind of suspiciously, a 10-year-old kid. Kind of an urchin coming into their store, but I had like a you know, a little five mil note in my hand, so they kind of knew I was legit. And I saw there were a lot of other rings, and they were much more expensive. And there was my gold ring, and it was only 5 mil. So I proudly bought it, and I paid for it, and I was so proud of myself to kind of restore my legacy. And then 2 weeks later, I found out why it was so cheap and so much cheaper than other rings, because the gold polish rubbed off, and I was left with a silver ring. And that's kind of the genesis behind the name of the firm. But the lessons I drew from that were, you know, twofold. One is that not everything that's cheap is actually a bargain. There's sometimes reasons for why things are cheap, and, you know, that's important to take into account. And two is it's important to do deep, in-depth research. You don't want to just kind of go based on numbers alone. You really want to understand the nature of what something is. It's sort of intrinsic value, if you will. So that was kind of the first story I wanted to relate to, because it really did influence my development as an investor. I would say the second story, very briefly, you know, my mom and I were living in New York at the time. I was a teenager. She got a job, and she, you know, had a little bit of savings, and she started getting, you know, some money that she wanted to invest into mutual funds. And I had no idea what investing. I was, you know, a teenage kid, I didn't know much. But here was my mom researching mutual funds, and I remember not the details even of the research. I remember a little bit about that, but it's really more what I remember is I remember, you know, the care she took, because even though she had very little money to save, it was really, really important to her. And that idea I got, that actually the way a mutual fund does over time can affect someone's life, can change when they retire, whether they can retire or put their kids through school or all of those things, was very real to me because I saw my mother kind of go through that and make those decisions. And she's very smart. She has a master's in math. So she took a lot of diligence trying to figure it out. But I remember how important it was to her to pick the right funds for her savings. So those were kind of two stories from my childhood, because when I entered the industry early on, about 20 years ago, I had, you know, that passion for what I was going to do was going to impact people's lives if I do a good job, hopefully positively. And unfortunately, kind of as I entered the industry, I found that there's a lot of cynicism. You know, I'm not saying I don't want to, you know, cast shade on everyone. I think that, you know, there are plenty of people who are doing a good job, and I think there are a lot of people who are trying to do a good job. But I think there's also a lot of cynicism that the idea of the asset management business became a business first, and the goal was to maximize the manager's profits and make as much money as humanly possible, as long as it's legal and you don't get in trouble. And I think that's a very low bar, and I think we could do better. And that was part of what, you know, motivated me to start Silver Ring Value Partners 4 years ago, or 16 years after I started in the industry, because I thought that we could do things a little differently than maybe the standard asset gathering model and so forth. Anyway, so those are a couple of stories I wanted to relate to, because I think they do matter. And I think when I talk to people, a lot of times people ask me for advice about starting a fund, and I ask them what's causing you to do this. And there are a few answers. Pretty much everyone cares about money, and that's fine. I'm a capitalist. I'm proud of being a capitalist, by the way. I'm not apologizing at all for that. I left the Soviet Union, which was a communist country, and I don't want to go back. I'm happy to be here. But I think if that's your only reason, that's going to affect how you behave as an investor. The next reason people give is, well, I love, it's interesting, it's fun. Okay, that's good, but so what? Okay. Another reason people don't give, but sometimes they give, sometimes they don't, is they're competitive, they want to win, and they like the scorecard aspect for it. And that's fine. It's good to want to win. But I think if you don't have a deeper motivation for why you're doing something, a lot of times it's going to influence how you're going to do it, especially when you're under the most pressure. Speaking of pressure, let's talk about the value versus growth debate. And I think it's been a hot topic. There's a small dwindling band of value investors still left talking about value investing, right? And every month or every quarter, someone drops either they go out of business, or they convert to a family office because it's just too painful, or whatever, right? You know, maybe they could become a growth investor. And by the way, I'm not saying that one style is better than another. So as Graham mentioned, I teach the value investing seminar at the local business school here in the Boston area. And I always tell my students, you know, there's no best way to invest, but there is a best way to invest for you. And what that means is you have to be, you know, realistic about your strengths and weaknesses. And you have to be realistic about what you your circumstances are and how you can best create an investment approach that caters to the circumstances and your strengths and weaknesses. So when I talk about value versus growth, most people basically assume cheap stocks versus glamour stocks, right? Stocks that are beaten down versus stocks that are growing rapidly and have strong momentum. So I think that debate kind of misses the point. And I think it's relevant if you're a factor investor and you're just buying things based on price to book or something like that, or trailing PE blindly, and you're buying hundreds of thousands of stocks. Okay, that matters perhaps. Or if you're managing billions and billions of dollars, because look, then your world looks like you're picking between Wells Fargo, GE, JP Morgan, and a few other companies, right? It's a small handful, let's be honest, that you can actually practically invest in a size that would matter. So yeah, then maybe it matters a bit, this debate about how the market values certain companies. But if you have a more nimble pool of capital, which I think most of us fall into that category. I think the debate is misguided because if you can find both and you don't have to have this religious debate about value versus growth. I think the best way to illustrate is a couple of examples from this year. So just a little disclaimer. These are not stock recommendations, and I'm not going to give you any recommendations. I'm not in the stock recommendations business. These are just examples, real world examples that I invested in earlier this year. So the first business is a company called Covetrus, and it was a spinoff and a merger of two different businesses, which mature vet distribution business. So they take pharmaceuticals made for animals and distribute them to veterinarians, and that was combined with a very high growth software as a service platform for vets, which helps them compete in the online retail world and basically sell to their customers online, which is a very hot area. And it was growing very rapidly. Distribution business mature, historically grew organically mid-single digits, and was producing about 60 cents of earnings per share. The SaaS business was producing almost nothing, was around break even, but it was growing 30% plus pre-COVID, and it was actually a big beneficiary of COVID. And so, by the way, just worth mentioning that the loans that the company had, the balance sheet, the covenants were very loose. And there was also almost no way the company could go bankrupt, even if there were a prolonged, say, recession or whatnot. So if you look at this, I have the stock chart, but it might be a little bit hard to see. You had plenty of times this year you could buy the stock for under $10 per share. And if you were really on point and you were watching things, you could buy it for $5-6 per share. Now, each of these two businesses, in my estimation, is worth more than $10 per share. How much more? Time will tell. But, just the distribution business alone, to me, is clearly worth more than $5-6 per share when it was trading at a low. So here's a company which was a pretty high growing company long term, in my view, but that the market just irrationally sold off for various reasons that I'm not going to get into because it's not my goal here to do a deep dive. I just want to kind of illustrate. You can look up where the stock is trading now if you want. The multiple has changed quite a bit. So now everyone is very excited about the growth and this and that. My point is you could have had this growth company for a very value price if you did your homework, if you were prepared, and if you were ready to act when it was a little scary in the market. Yeah. So I think, again, false dichotomy in terms of growth versus value. You just need to be disciplined on price if you're managing a nimble pool of capital. The next example is even more recent, and this is a more challenged business. So the company I want to describe briefly is Qurate Retail. It owns the QVC and Home Shopping Network brands, and its niche is basically TV-aided retail. The idea is that it's going to entertain you and sell things to you, but there's a treasure hunt aspect to it. And Amazon's tried to compete with them. They have not really made a dent. So it's been around for a long time. The key aspect to this business is that there is a very large, almost subscription-like component to it because a large cohort of the buyers that account for the significant majority of the revenues are loyal buyers that come year after year. They make 20 purchases or so per year. And they essentially have a 1% annual churn rate, meaning that it would take a very long time for them to kind of disappear. And this is a business, that in the 18 and 19 has seen organic sales declines in the low single digits as QVC absorbed Home Shopping Network and there was some integration challenges. And maybe it's long-term, it's a declining business. I don't know. Maybe it's a flat business. Maybe it's a moderately growing business, but it's not a rapidly growing business under most circumstances. It does have an able management team. It's part of the John Malone Liberty complex of companies. And the management, which had been buying back stock, kind of got tired of this. And so they said, okay, we're going to do something different. We are going to issue a one-time special dividend of $1.50 per share. And we are also going to do something unusual, which is issue a $3 per share dividend in the form of a preferred stock. So just for reference, after this event was announced, the current run rate of cash flow, free cash flow per share, EPS was about $2 per share. And by the way, COVID, again, helped this business. Sales are actually now growing. Now, that's probably to a degree temporary, but it's still, the point is, it's not like this business was under pressure from COVID and the business was imploding or anything like that. Sales were actually growing the last quarter reported. Prior to this announcement, sales grew almost 10%. So again, this was not a business falling off a cliff. But even if it were, you could have bought it the day after the event with huge volume for 3x free cash flow. So I'm going to pause and repeat, for 3x free cash flow, meaning that in 3 years, you would get your money back if free cash flow didn't drop. And as I earlier pointed out, there is a very large percentage, I think 80% or so, of the sales that comes from these loyal customers that basically don't go away. And sales haven't exactly been falling off a cliff. So you can talk about retail is scary. What's the future? What does 10 years from now look like for this business? What's the terminal value? But it's 3x free cash flow. And so you don't need to know what's going to happen in 10 years because you're going to get a very nice rate of return by then, irrespective of what year 10 free cash flow looks like, as long as that free cash flow doesn't fall off a cliff in the immediate, you know, year or two. So again, you can check out for yourself what happened to the stock. The point is the opportunity was right there. By the way, a little vignette. I talked about this as soon as the event came out. I told three of my friends who work for large shops, very large, well-known companies that will remain unnamed, and I got various reasons for why they weren't going to look at it. And these are smart, experienced value investors, right? And it's basically the reason came down to mental fatigue. And they were just tired. They were just tired of cheap stocks that weren't going up. So they were buying cheap stocks. They were going lower, becoming cheaper. They were just mentally exhausted. And when you tell them, I got a cheap retailer for you, they stop. Their mind shuts off. And I said, guys, look, you know me well. We've known each other for a long time. This isn't some, you know, retail that's about to go bankrupt. Like, just you have to look at the economics. You have to look at the numbers. Nobody acted. Not a single person. And by the way, there's plenty of volume. These people could have bought a reasonable stake in the business in the aftermath of the special event. Anyway, the point of these two, the Covetrus story and the QA story, which, by the way, isn't over. I'm not bragging. I could very well end up being wrong here. I'm kind of showing you kind of almost kind of live. This is value investing live after all, right? You know, kind of ways that I'm implementing the process, that there are ways to find growth stocks that sometimes occasionally are the value price. And there are ways to find value stocks. You don't have to have debate about the larger value universe and whether banks are too cheap and interest rates will rise, where it's very event specific or company-specific questions, and the odds you're getting are hugely in your favor to at least not lose money, if not to make a very decent or better return with a big margin of safety. All right, that brings me to my investment process. I'm going to go through this rather quickly at a high level. Feel free to ask me questions because I want to leave ample time for Q&A. But first, I think that having an investment process is crucial. And how many people honestly have a written investment process? Not like a marketing deck that you kind of talk to your prospects and then never actually use or use 80% of the time or 2/3 of the time, but like actual process that you use it all the time. I've been in this business for 20 years and I've been inside the sausage factories, and it's not often that people actually are doing exactly what their process says. And yet it's so important because I think you don't need to be brilliant in this business. I think you need to have sufficient IQ, work hard, but more importantly, have the right framework and then have the temperament to stick to it when it's not working. Because investing has a very long feedback loop, right? You know, I always like to tell my students, well, like, what has a short feedback loop, right? It's like you take a nail and you hammer it in. Well, very quickly, you know if you are good at this, because if you hit your finger and it hurts, you're not good at this, and you either change your process or you need to hire someone to do your hammering for you. Well, investing, it might take years. It does take years, many years, to know if you're any good. And in the short term, all you have is the quality of your process and the decisions you're making. So you need to have a written process. It's also a way to commit yourself to a process you believe in when things are calm and your mind is clear, so that when things are hectic, the market is falling, that, you know, when, who knows, you know, your business is under duress because, you know, maybe people don't believe in value investing anymore. You have something that you believe in that you think is a good way of investing you can stick to. And this is what it is for me. Very briefly, Silver and Value Partners, I really focus on trying to be competent. I'll let you be the judge of that. Having alignment and really being passionate about investing for the right reasons. You know, the approach is pretty straightforward. Intrinsic value, which means partial ownership in a business. High margin of safety based on both the quality of what we're buying and also the price that we're paying. A long-term time horizon. Rational and disciplined execution, and a concentrated portfolio. I think the competitive advantage know, so it's funny. When I was starting, people would ask, what's your competitive advantage? And one of my business friends said, you know, Gary, I would feel a lot better if you told me you had some satellite that I can check into, like, the factories and see what demand is going to be next quarter. And I kind of chuckled and said, first, I don't have such a satellite. Second, even if I did, I'm a long-term guy. I don't really know what to do with it. And so I think that my competitive advantage is not one thing, which is unfortunate, because when you meet some of these allocators, they're like, they want to hear some, you know, some answer that fits their mental model to check their box. And, you know, the truth is more nuanced than that. It's a long-term time horizon, because how many people really are going to buy something that if they're told for sure, it's not going to go anywhere for years? Very few, trust me, I know. It's a limited asset base, because then you can take advantage of the smaller opportunities that are more inefficiently priced. It's a microeconomic focus, because then you don't have to spend your time thinking about interest rates or what the Fed is going to do or what stimulus this or that. You're trying to answer different kinds of questions. And finally, most importantly, temperament, which is perhaps the hardest to prove, because anyone can show, say on the slide that they have the right temperament, but a very small percentage of them will actually act in the way that that temperament would suggest they should. So let's talk about idea generation, which is the first part. Now, there's, I have a three-step funnel, and the reason is I want to include a very broad set of companies first. Then I want to exclude any that don't fit the bill for any reason very quickly, and be left with a small handful that I'll do a deeper dive in. There are four kind of sources of investing ideas, or four idea streams. So I have a high-quality watch list of companies that I already identified as good businesses that I want to keep an eye on. I have value screens, which is probably the least valuable source of ideas these days. I think that's been pretty commoditized, but I still do it, and I use long-term free cash flow yield as one metric that is somewhat useful to me. I like special situations like spin-offs, post-bankruptcies and such. And by the way, we had, you know, I guess Covetrus was a spin-off, and Curate Retail had an event that kind of made it a special situation. But I also am not embarrassed to say I have a value investing network of other investors I respect that I share ideas with. And by the way, Curate Retail is something that a good friend of mine in business, Patrick Brennan, called, who, you know, is the deepest expert I know on the Liberty Complex. And he said, you got to really look at it. And I kind of said, it's a retailer, right? You know, and he's like, no, Gary, you got to look at this thing. And I said, you know what, Patrick, I respect you quite a bit. I'm going to take a look. By the way, taking a look doesn't mean I'm going to buy everything that, you know, someone suggests. All it means is, to go back a slide, is it goes into the top of the funnel, and then I put it through the process. And by the way, once something is in this top of the funnel, I actually don't keep track of the source on purpose, because I want to make sure I'm not biased towards one source or another. So that's kind of where ideas come from. Now, what do we do once we have an idea and we want to research it? Well, I think it's important to be disciplined, and I have a five-step research process. And the goal is, to step back, is to answer two questions. One is, how predictable is the long-term economic outcome of the business? And two is, what is the reasonable range of intrinsic values? So very briefly, and again, I'll go in more depth if you have questions, but I'd rather save time for Q&A. You know, company quality assessment comes down to business quality, balance sheet quality, and management quality. Step two is figuring out, what are the few things I really want to know if I were to close my eyes and open them in 5 years or 10 years? What would be the important drivers? And try to make it as specific as possible. So sales, margins, that's great, but how do I make it specific to this company? For example, for Covetrus, one key metric was, for the SaaS business, revenue per practice. That was the key, right, to how valuable that business is going to be. That's one of the things I'm tracking. That's very important to the value of that part of the business. So understanding that, understanding what that should be and why, or the range of possible values, is important. Step three, financial modeling, model a range of scenarios from worst to best, with the base case being the most likely. Step four, value the business based on that model and a range of values. My primary tool is discounted cash flow analysis, but I check using multiples. I look at private market transactions. I, you know, want to make sure that I'm not in some ivory tower coming up with some crazy number that only makes sense in my model or in my head, that these are realistic numbers. By the way, as you know, Curate is a great example. If you need a microscope to figure out if something's undervalued, I'll give you a hint. It is not undervalued. Like, you just need, like, three times free cash flow is straightforward. You buy it. If the cash flow doesn't decline, your and stays there forever, you get a 33% annualized rate of return if you own the business forever. It's simple. It's clearly cheap. Now your questions you have to answer is that cash flow going to fall off a cliff to make it, the price justified? And if you can convince yourself that that's not the case, then it's a bargain. On the other hand, if you're going to ask me questions, do you use a 9.3 or 10.7 discount rate, then you're missing the point. That shouldn't be, like, that level of precision is neither attainable nor desirable for real value investing, in my view. Finally, I like a behavioral checklist. I think I'm a big believer in biases. I know everyone else is biased except for me. I'm kidding, obviously, right? You know, I know I'm biased. But by the way, one of the most common biases is that we're all above average, and we kind of all want to believe we're above average in something, and we are. But there are probably many things that we believe we're above average and that we probably are not, right? And so there's a whole other host of biases. I use a checklist approach to just run down through them to try and minimize them. I don't think it's possible to eliminate them, but I think you, with rigor, can decrease their impact on your process. So that's the research process. You know, very briefly, I have thresholds for where I would invest in companies. That's a function of quality. So the higher the quality, the more the margin of safety comes from the quality, I still want a discount to the value, but the discount could be a bit smaller. And the more the business is in the average category, the more drastic I want the price discount to be. That being said, I try not to traffic, or I don't traffic in below average businesses, because frequently they're just too hard to value. And I know there are some investors who will say, well, there's a price for everything. And at the extreme, that's probably true. Like 1 cent a share or something like that for most businesses, probably they're a bargain. But in practice, I've made so many early mistakes. Feel free to ask me about them in the Q&A. Early in my career as an analyst, where I thought the business was so cheap, I bought it and I was humiliated and humbled for many years. So as a result of all those mistakes, I think I hopefully got a little bit better, and I try not to do terrible businesses. But I also don't just restrict myself to only the best companies in the world, because I don't think they get mispriced often enough and by enough to make that, for me, a fruitful endeavor. I have my selling process. We can talk about that if you want. I do try to make sure that in terms of position size, I do have a concentrated portfolio. My positions range between 5% and 15%, with 10% being medium, 5 small, 15 large. So to become a medium or a large position, it's not enough for you to be a cheap stock. You need to have something else going for you. You need to have limited downside or above average business quality. Because one of the mistakes I see kind of value investors make is they size positions in a huge way that are terrible, or at least average businesses, where the only thing they have going for them is cheap, right? I want something other than cheap if you're going to be a big position for me. Cheap is important, and it's a must-have, or undervalued, not cheap necessarily, but undervalued. But I also want to have other characteristics as well for the larger positions. So the goal is really not to permanently impair capital. This is naturally going to be a very volatile process month to month, sometimes unpleasantly so. But it's important to remember that in the short term, it's pretty random, right? I was explaining this to my 7-year-old son, who I'm teaching probability, that a lot of this is, you know, in the short term, it's like throwing the dice. You don't know what's going to come. But if you're throwing 2 dice, you know that a 7 is a lot more likely than the 2, right? You know, so over time, things do converge to your process and to the underlying probability distributions. The portfolio, I don't use leverage. I don't short. I do use options to hedge occasionally. It's not a big component of what I do, but I do it when it makes sense. But by and large, it's 10 to 20 investments, well-researched, with a long-term time horizon and a big margin of safety. This slide says, don't sue me, do your work. And then this is where you can find me, and I'll shut up and let Graham ask any questions if there are any.
All righty. Thank you so much for that presentation, Gary. It was great to go through everything. We do have a pretty large list of questions here building up from our audience. We can go ahead and jump into things from the top. Starting off, one of our viewers is asking, if it's not proprietary information, would you mind divulging a little bit of the formulas that you like to use for intrinsic value and margin of safety and things like that?
Sure. I mean, I use a DCF of equity cash flows with a 10% discount rate. You know, you can have a long debate about that, but if you find yourself having that long debate, it means that you're not focused on the right thing. Usually, though, It also works if you apply a PE for stable businesses. So think about a business that's pretty linear, right? It's growing at some rate. The current earnings are normal and not unusually high and unusually low. There's not a big difference in using a price to earnings methodology versus a DCF methodology. Now take a pharma company where one product is rapidly dropping off, another is hockey sticking up as it was just launched, and the PE methodology makes no sense, right? Because it's nonlinear set of assets with finite cash flows, because you know afterwards they're gonna patents are gonna expire. So a DCF is a little bit more robust, but simplistically, if the what I'm looking for, if I were a permanent owner of a business, is a 12% plus IRR, meaning with no change to the business, no change to the capital structure, can I get, you know, for a great business, a 12% IRR from holding it?
Looks like we might have lost him here, folks. Give us a moment while we try and reconnect.
Maybe to tie it into what we were just talking about, but when the bad things happen, you have to have a plan and it can be a terrible failure. So network died. I have another network. That's part of an example of margin of safety. But kidding aside, in valuation, what I was trying to say is it should kind of hit you over the head as obvious, because if it doesn't, it's probably not undervalued. But you want to think about the kind of rate of return you're going to get as an owner of the business. And as I was saying, in my partnership, I have a 6% hurdle rate. I've defined a job well done as high single-digit nominal returns or better with low risk of permanent capital loss. That's my true north. And I won't intentionally invest in an asset if I don't think it's going to give me at least a 12% rate of return.
Definitely. All righty. So we'll keep on jamming through this list of questions here. One that I think we should have a very or a relatively clear answer to directly in front of us here on the screen. Do you have a value investing course? It seems like you have a manual kind of setup that people can get access to here.
Yeah, I share the same owner's manual. It's not a marketing document. It's what I actually used to communicate to my partners originally when I was launching what this will be. And the idea came from the Buffett partnership days, is that just be transparent. And in there, I outline my whole process. I have had over 1,000 people who have requested it. I've always sent it. A lot of times it's students. So I'm happy to share it. I do teach a course. Unfortunately, it's only for people affiliated with that business school because they're hosting it. What I do have on the Behavioral Value Investor site is a value investing reading course, which is kind of the sequence of books I use for my value investing seminar and why, you should use, what you should try to get from each book, very briefly. So it's not quite a course, but it's an outline for a self-study program, which, by the way, the first book, Security Analysis, I've read 4 times now in 20 years. And every time I've read it, I get something new, some nuance, something I missed the first time, or I've had a set of experiences that maybe made some part more meaningful. So I would say that there's plenty of opportunity. I think the value is having a mentor or someone who can teach you and give you feedback on how you're applying the process. And that's something that a book can't do for you. I was fortunate my early days at Fidelity. I worked with a great investor, a gentleman by the name of Joel Tillinghast, who manages a low price stock fund. And, he really had a big impact on how my style developed. And I try to give back essentially by mentoring people, and teaching this course here in the Boston area. But I don't have anything that's online. I certainly don't have a paid course or anything like that. I only have one business, and that's managing people's capital.
Definitely. And I know that'll answer another one or two questions we had on people interested in that program as well.
I had a good friend, by the way, who is older than me and senior investor once another shop semi-seriously just texted me earlier today if they can sign up for this course. I had to give him the same answer, even though he's a dear friend. So it's not my rules, it's the school's. I apologize.
Definitely. And jumping ahead now, what do you think of the acquirer multiple, so EV versus EBIT?
Yeah, I think it's a good look. I think that I have friends who always think about things from an enterprise value point of view, because in theory, it's better because it takes into account debt as well. Where it matters or where it will likely give you a different answer is where you have when you have too much leverage, right? So if you have a company that, say, can only, you know, handle a, you know, three times EBITDA in debt for whatever reason. That's the maximum that's safe. But some private equity sponsor levers it to 6 times and then IPOs it and it takes it to a bunch of innocent, you know, victim mutual fund managers, I mean, you know, customers to sell on a price to earnings basis. It will look cheap on a PE basis, but that will be a deception because it has over levered. So if you were the owner of that business and you had a free cash flow stream, you would have to use the first bunch of years of free cash flow to reduce debt to a sustainable level. Essentially, the first few years of equity free cash flow wouldn't be free at all. You would be going towards a mandatory debt pay down. So using enterprise value to EBIT or EBITA, I'm not a big fan of EBITDA, but EBITA is usually better because most of the time amortization is not a real cost, but depreciation is via CapEx. However, if the company has a sustainable capital structure, meaning the debt is not too high, I don't see why a free cash flow to equity or P approach is incorrect, because ultimately it doesn't matter how much debt there is as long as it's sustainable for this business, and how much, that's a separate discussion, what makes one balance sheet structure correct for a business versus another. But I find that if you're doing kind of quantitative analysis, and if you're like using kind of the magic formula from Joel Greenblatt on thousands of companies, EV to EBIT probably gets rid of some false positives, of meaning things that look cheap but really aren't. But if you're doing deep dive analysis into a handful of stocks and you're competent, you can isolate the few instances where there's too much leverage and handle that. So I think it's a useful tool, but I also think that it's not necessarily necessary if you know what you're doing.
Gotcha. And another question here on a little bit more of a personal note. How has the CFA helped you achieve what you have today? And do you think it's important for younger people to take it up if they really want to know more about investing?
Yeah, so I think, so it's interesting. So CFA is a, you know, credential. You know, it shows that you studied hard for 3 tests and absorbed the body of knowledge, and you have a certain number of years of experience. It used to be 3, maybe it's 4 now. I've lost track because I got mine, you know, almost 20 years ago. So I never went to business school. I'm going to admit it. You know, I want to confess to you, I'm not a master of business administration, guys. Sorry, disappoint. And so when I was at Fidelity as an analyst, it certainly seemed helpful to have a credential. Was it helpful educationally? Yes. Was it like what made me a good investor? Not at all. I think there are plenty of CFAs who are terrible investors and plenty of people who are not CFAs who are good investors, right? So I don't remember Warren Buffett passing the CFA exam, by the way, but maybe, or Charlie Munger, but maybe I'm wrong. So I think for most people early in their career nowadays, it's a very quick summary certification that shows that they're serious about this business, and especially if you don't go to Wharton or Columbia Business School or, you know, Harvard or whatever, it's a very quick way of saying, I'm serious, I want to be in this business, and put my resume near the top of the pile. Unfortunately, I don't think that there's some things that are useful, but a lot of the modern finance theory, portfolio theory they teach, I don't use, I don't agree with, I don't want to judge that it's wrong, but I just don't find it practically useful for what I do. So I don't think it's something that if you were honestly trying to improve yourself as an investor, that's not where I would point to. But if you're trying to improve your chance of getting a job while learning some useful things and some things that maybe are, say, are questionable, at least for this narrow niche of value investing, it certainly is a good thing to do.
So you'd call it a good foot in the door, but definitely not a defining characteristic.
Correct. And I think, unfortunately, these days, if you'd have no MBA and no CFA, you stand out in a negative way, right? It's like, is this person legit, right? So, you know, and there's such a so I have this unpaid remote internship where with a few people at a time, I do my value investing course one-on-one, and in exchange, they do some, you know, basic light modeling for me remotely for, you know, 5 hours a week or something like that. And I have such an overwhelming demand for this program, despite it being unpaid, because it's so hard to get into the industry. It's not because I'm so amazing or world famous. Obviously, I'm not. However, I think I'm competent, and I try to be a good person, a good mentor. I hope that counts for something. But my point is that there's just so many people who are hungry to get into the business that if you leave yourself without credentials, unfortunately, you're at a disadvantage. But the best way to get a job is not a CFA. It's proving yourself to someone and getting a foot in the door in a good firm where you can get the right mentor. Because I think in this business, the first investor you work with is going to be a huge influence both on your development as an investor and, frankly, on the perception that others are going to have of you. It's still a master apprentice business. This is kind of like, you know, one of those very few old-fashioned industries where the very best usually have apprenticed with someone who was excellent as well before them.
Definitely. And switching back towards the investment side of things, do you take a look at international opportunities and how do you find them?
Yeah, I do. I mean, my criteria are, you know, quality financial statements in English, rule of law, and the market rather than the governments dictating the majority of the economic outcome. Beyond that, I don't care. So in practice, that leads me away from like completely emerging markets and more into US, UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, parts of continental Europe. I have a good friend who has been encouraging to for me to take a look at markets like South Korea, for example. Some of it is just lack of familiarity. Some of it is knowing the management teams and their reputation is much more important in those markets, I think. And I think I might be the patsy at the table in some ways, because I think in those markets, there are families that add a lot of value and build value for shareholders, and then there are crooks out there. And I think as a guy, you know, I don't want to be the Bloomberg jockey from Boston, you know, coming and say, oh, I found this really cheap Vietnamese company. This is awesome. I'm going to buy a lot of it and find out that everyone in Vietnam is, I don't know, who knows what's going on, you know, knows that these guys are cheats or something like that, right? And I'm the last one to know. So I don't go too far, and I'd say the majority of what I do is in the U.S., but I own a Canadian company, I've owned a British company, I own a Dutch company. I'm really equal opportunity based on the nature of the business and my ability to assess it, not based on the domicile of the business.
Gotcha. And looks like we did answer this question on being a part of that value investing seminar. So moving past there, what are your thoughts on cryptocurrency right now?
None. I know some people who made a lot of money. I always get propositioned by people on LinkedIn how, you know, if only I reply, click on their link and engage with them and schedule a 30-minute call, I'll be very wealthy. I'm sure I cost myself millions by not, you know, setting up those calls. But I don't really know how to value it. I understand the scarcity argument, but, and I don't want to say anything crude, but there's a lot of things that are scarce but not good, right? Just scarcity alone doesn't make something valuable. You know, I'll quote Charlie Munger. He said that something along the lines that there are some turds, weirdly shaped turds, that are very scarce, but that doesn't mean that they should be worth a lot of money. So there, I defer the crudeness to someone else who's much older and wiser than I am. But I'm not doing it for religious reasons or because Warren Buffett said. I don't think it fits into my framework of how do I model the cash flow stream. Am I worried, by the way, about inflation? I am worried about inflation because, I don't know, I just think when you print money, eventually, you know, the fancy suits out there in Washington and other places might make a mistake or two, which has been known to happen, and we could end up with a much higher level of inflation. I would love to find a way to manage the tail risk of that, but I've chosen to do that through maybe businesses with pricing power, for example, than by just saying buying gold or buying Bitcoin. Although, again, the last year has made me a lot more worried because if you look at, you know, how much we have printed money, at some point you kind of believe that the money should become worth less. But long-winded way of saying, I don't know.
Definitely. And you mentioned there tail end type risk, and we jumping ahead here in our question list. We do have a question. How do you go about finding companies with a low tail end risk that you can be confident on moving into the future?
So I think you're looking for asymmetry of tails, ideally, right? So Covetrus is a good example. So there are risks, like, you know, if I were to say, you know, to just go back to Covetrus for a second, you know, as, to use it as an example, you know, distribution business is under pressure from consolidating suppliers. That's a real risk. Is it a tail risk? No, because it's not going to kill the business. It'll probably make it somewhat less profitable or lower growth. There's another risk that the business shifting online. That's a tail risk, but not tail risk, again, of complete death. Something decimating the business that's probably reducing its growth rate, or maybe even making a declining business. That's possible. There's some potential for, I guess, some regulatory risk, but it's so low here because you're distributing drugs to veterinarians, it to be almost very low. Now, in the SaaS business, you have right tail possibilities. And what I mean by that is I would say this is a bell curve, but with a very long right tail, because this business could be worth $60, $70, $80 per share. But that's, you know, they have to execute for many years for that to be the case. And there's no way to believe that that's necessarily the base case for that business. But there is very little left tail risk in my view, because they're already successful. They are growing rapidly. They have, you know, 35, 40% installed base penetration. So it's very low risk that this thing is worthless, but some small but not insignificant probability that this thing is worth, you know, multiples of what the current business is trading at. So I like those scenarios. How do you guard against, the more relevant question is, how do you guard against tail risk at the portfolio level? Because you have a portfolio, especially a concentrated portfolio. And, you know, I was talking, I don't want to name drop, so I won't, but I was talking to a very thoughtful, you know, well-known investor in Boston, and he was kind enough to share his thoughts. And there is no, like, I told him, you know what, I wish I could put 0.5% or 1% of the fund into something that if there's a disaster, it just pays off and insures me against it. And he's like, well, I have news for you. First of all, if I knew it, I wouldn't tell you, but I would tell you it exists so you could go find it if you do the work. But two is, I haven't found it. So, and there's also more than one tail risk. There's tail risk of inflation. There's tail risk of deflation. There's tail risk of social unrest and the rule of law faltering, right? Which, you know, could happen, and who knows? I think the best way of thinking about it is thinking through your portfolio and making sure that there is not one set of events, inflation, deflation, low interest rates, high interest rates, that's going to give you a terrible outcome. And essentially what you're doing is you're paying a tax on the positive returns that you're going to get to make sure that you're drastically decreasing the probability or the magnitude of what a bad result looks like. Because I think, look, you can afford to have many subpar years as long as eventually you hit, you know, your investments bear fruit. But you can't afford having minus 50% years. And I've seen value investors who get so dogmatic about, this is cheap, I'm going to put more money and more money. So they put a bunch of their portfolio, 40, 50, 60%, into very highly correlated investments. And then it doesn't work out. They have terrible returns. And then they may say, oh, gee, value investing is, you know, it hasn't been working, which I get that it hasn't. It's not completely an excuse. But you also, I think, have to be willing to be rational, sacrifice some upside. Even so, if something is dirt cheap, doesn't mean it needs to be 30% of your portfolio. So I think finding businesses that have resilience, or maybe in some cases anti-fragility. So for example, Covetrus turned out to be anti-fragile with respect to the lockdowns because its online business increased. Surprisingly, Qurate was anti-fragile with respect to lockdowns as well because of the shift to online or non-in-person retail. Now, offsetting that, I had, you know, I own a company called Owens Illinois. You know, they make glass and beer bottles. So on-premise consumption declined. So at bars, people don't go to bars as much. For a while, their sales got hurt, but then it shifted off-premise where people still like one beer or wine. Trust me, you know, I'm a father of three. I know I'm not going to, I don't want to suggest that I want them too much, but occasionally, yeah, we do want them. And so people just shifted that consumption to home. So there was a resilience there versus something like that. So I think thinking about the businesses deeply, and then I still worry a lot that maybe I miss some tail risk at the portfolio level. So I think about this a lot. I don't have a perfect answer, but I think that the more I think about it, the more I think about it, both at the individual company level and at the portfolio level, the more I can cut off the tail of a really bad outcome, which is something I do worry about a lot.
Understood. Seems like just finding that right balance.
It is.
And jumping ahead here, interesting question that tends to come up a decent amount here in these presentations. Do you think it's better to buy a good company that is fairly valued or wait for discounted opportunities, considering that those opportunities seem to be fewer and further between nowadays?
Yeah, so first of all, this whole Buffett quote that people latch onto, that it's better to buy a great business at a fair price than a fair business at a great price, he doesn't actually believe that. That's just, oh, well, he means, that's not true. He means something different from it, right? So let's get that straight, because I know in private, I know secondhand, not firsthand, he said, when asked about this, I don't want to buy a great business at a fair price. I want to buy a great business at a ridiculous price, right? So first of all, so that's the truth. Let's be honest. Okay. Second of all, when he says fair, what does fair mean? Let's think about this. Fair. So he's buying mostly companies. Let's think about this because he buys more companies now almost than stocks. He's not changing them, not changing the management, not changing the capital structure. So therefore, the cash flow stream he's buying is going to have some internal rate of return, some IRR. The seller is giving it up. The buyer gets it, right? That's the transaction. Now, of course, it benefits Buffett to go and say, look, I'm paying fair prices, guys. Keep selling to me. I want more sellers to come and call me, right? He could say publicly, well, I want good businesses at ridiculously cheap prices, but then who's going to be really excited about selling to him, right? So let's get the Buffett part of the way. He's not looking for – fair might mean something, but it certainly doesn't mean that he doesn't want abnormally high IRRs, which he does, which means the seller is giving those up. So second of all, I think it depends – to answer a specific question, depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Let's give three scenarios. One is you are managing a $10 billion fund. You really can't wait. What are you going to wait for? A big market sell-off? That's silly. We know market timing is extremely hard and really doesn't work. At least it hasn't worked for anyone I've known consistently. So you have to be fully invested. You're probably running a mutual fund at that point, and you convince yourself that, well, your investors already gave you money to invest in equity, so therefore that whole mantra, which is to me nonsense, I think your investors gave you money to grow their capital by investing in equities. However, I talked to friends in the industry who are in it. Well, we have to be fully invested. So they end up buying what's called the tallest midget sometimes, which is the least bad investments when there aren't any good available, especially at their size. Let's go to the other extreme. You're an individual investor and you're managing your own portfolio. You have not accountable to anyone. You can do whatever you want, and you're nimble and you know what you're doing. You should wait for really, really fat pitches, right? And you would be crazy to be here debating Wells Fargo versus GE. Like, why? Like, these are complex, hard questions. Like, find easy questions to answer. Because investing is like a multiple choice exam. So except that in a normal exam, you have 100 questions. And if you don't know an answer, you should guess C or whatever, because at least you get some chance of getting it right. But the trick with investing is you only get greater than the questions you're answering. So if you have 100 questions, you would be silly to guess or even take a stab at something you think you might know. You should just answer the very few questions that you're absolutely sure about or near sure. You're never sure investing, but as close to sure as possible. So you should totally not pay lukewarm prices for good businesses, because we kind of know who the good businesses are, right? There's not a lot of debate that Amazon is a good business, or that Google is a good business, or Facebook is a good business, or whatever. There's some debate about some of these newfangled companies that are coming, they're burning cash and they're not, profitable. But the other ones I mentioned, they're real businesses, they're hugely profitable. We all know they're good businesses. The debate is that they're mispriced. So I think the third scenario is if you're managing a flexible pool of capital like I am, I would put myself much more in the category of the individual, a savvy individual investor rather than the $10 billion manager. I'm not forced to buy anything. I told my partners I will hold as much cash as is necessary as a stopping over point if there's nothing intelligent to do that meets my absolute criteria. By the way, that is the difference between a relative value investor and an absolute value investor. And if you say you're going to always be fully invested, by definition, you're a relative value investor, which might be fine. But I don't think that that's how you would invest your own personal money. At least I hope it wouldn't be. So you're doing something for marketing reasons or to fit into some style box or whatever, rather than what makes the most sense. So what makes most sense to me is you wait for Fed pitches. You don't have to have everything be, I think the 20 punch card analogy that Buffett talks about maybe is a little bit too stringent, but it's not 2,000 punch cards either, you know?
Definitely. And thanks for diving into that one. And jumping on, looks like we're kind of buttoned up close here to our time limit, so we'll try and jam through these last couple of questions real quick.
Lightning round. Lightning round. Let's do it.
Exactly.
Ready.
Going through this whole COVID situation and the pandemic and everything, have there been any changes or improvements to your process that have come about?
No, but I think it just reinforced that risk management is really important. I was really glad I was doing it, and I'm paying even more attention to it now.
Definitely. And we kind of jumped over it there in the presentation. And for those watching, as I mentioned, answering one of those questions, a full recording will be available so you can flip back through those slides and things like that. But getting to a selling point, kind of your hit list there, why sell or not sell at any given time?
Yeah, so... the selling discipline is, there's price to value gap closed. Hopefully it closed by price going up to value, not my value estimate going down to price, but that does happen. You have to be rational. Opportunity cost, let's say you don't have cash and you have something at 60 cents on a dollar and you have something at 80 cents on a dollar, might make sense to sell something at 80 cents on a dollar to buy something at 60 cents on a dollar. And, you know, the more important thing is the business breaks or you lose confidence in the management. I think when you, especially if you lose the confidence in the management's integrity, that's a very important, well, if you can replace the management, that would be a good time to do it. Most of us can't. But otherwise, I think it's time to move on, because if you don't trust the people who are who have the ability to take your free cash flow and either put it in their own pocket or put it on fire pursuing dumb deals, how are you going to use a DCF to value it? So I think those are the reasons typically to sell something.
Definitely. And a good one for us to kind of end things off here. You mentioned that you do have that kind of that network of value investors surrounding you. Would there be any people or books, anything like that, that you would guide people towards to do their own research and kind of create that network for themselves?
I think, I one of my friends, Vitaly Kinson-Nelson, does ValueX Vail in the U.S. It's usually people for more established investors, kind of experienced value investors. So I met a few people through that. I think John Mihailovich at MOI Global has built a great community of investors globally, and I've gone through some of his international events and met people who I've then stayed in touch with and developed, and he's always happy. Like when I travel, I would email him and say, hey, is there anyone in this area to meet who's like-minded, so forth. So I think there are places. I think those places, they assume a little bit of seasoning. They're not for, like, if you're a college senior and you're trying to get into investing, I'm not sure how applicable that is. I think in that case, there are publications out there that you can read that come out on a regular basis. And frankly, reach out to people. I have had many people request informational interviews. I usually say yes. I always upfront. Informational interview means you're not asking for a job. There's no confusion. But beyond that, people have been very helpful and generous with my time. So I'll make this offer. If anyone wants, is that college senior, junior, whatever your stage of life is, and you want to just talk about your career, as long as we're clear that this is not a back end way to trying to get a job, I'll be more than happy to try to schedule a call and, give you whatever wisdom or lack thereof I can share.
Definitely. Well, Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today, give that great presentation, and dive into these questions from our live audience. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we do really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and sorry for the technical issues, but I'm glad we reconnected, and thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.